I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So I think we need to come up with like a sexy tough acronym for Rex Tillerson.
Mm-hmm. You know, you have like sexy def. Rexy,
or like, you know, like you have sex stuff. I was thinking Rex Sec.
Rex Sec.
Rex Sec.
Yeah, that sounds like a rucksack.
Rucksack,
or maybe like Brexit, but it doesn't sound sexy. I'm sorry.
No.
It sounds like OPSEC. Like it sounds like some kind of like
OPSEC.
Yeah, like a military. Like I think of it as like a military term.
Rex Sec. Yeah. No wait. Rex Sec.
Rex. Sec.
Are they just going to call him R in the building?
Yeah. No, R is already somebody in the
building.
Oh,
R is somebody.
Yeah.
They will just call him S, right, in the building?
Yes.
S. Mr. S.
Now God, I can't remember who R is. That's awful. I think R is the Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy.
No, not anymore.
You mean the person that Roger Ailes has now being floated as the occupant for?
Right.
Oh, okay. Roger Ailes will be R.
Do you think that Rex Sec will come in and say there's a new R in town? I'm sure that's what he'll do.
There's a new Rex Sec in town.
Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the Rex Sec edition. I'm Shane Harris of the Wall Street Journal. I would love to come up with an acronym for myself, but, you know, I'll stick with Shane.
We'll work on it.
We'll work
Shane,
on it.
Shane, it's a nice one syllable.
It's a good monosyllabic, strong,
powerful name.
Yes.
John Wayne name.
Yeah, although lots of girls are named Shane. Did you know that? It's actually become an androgynous name, which I'm all for.
Rock on.
All right.
All right, Lady Shanes.
Yes,
welcome.
Lady Shanes. Thank you for tuning in today. Well, we have like no news to get to on the podcast. Just kidding. This week, the CIA concludes. Oh, first of all, I'm here with my friends Tamara Kaufman Wittes and Susan Hennessy.
Jeez. Hi, Shane.
Hi, Shane. Before we even get to topics.
And no Ben Wittes. I feel bad that I forgot that Ben wasn't even here.
You forgot?
No, I mean, I went right on with
that. There's this gaping hole in our fellowship.
Yeah. Well, he's in Israel right now, rocking a good trip, right?
Yeah, I will say there is a gaping hole in the dish-doing duty at my house.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Big time.
Wow. Put those kids to work.
Hey, what are kids for?
Exactly. Manual
free
labor.
Free labor.
That's literally it.
Not illegal in your own house. Okay, the CIA concludes that Russian hackers tried to help Donald Trump get elected. Trump will nominate Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson as the next Secretary of State, and the Obama administration is confident that journalist Austin Tice, who has long been held hostage in Syria, is alive. And we will talk about what the future holds for other Americans held abroad as the Obama administration comes to a close. Let's start with the obvious news of the week. On Friday night, it was reported in the Washington Post that the CIA about a week or so earlier told senators that they had concluded that the hacks of the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman were not just designed to interfere with the U.S. election, but were in fact an attempt to help boost Donald Trump's chances of winning the election and hurt Hillary Clinton's campaign. Something that obviously a lot of people had speculated might be the case, but we had not seen any kind of official expression of that before. The counter to this from the Trump campaign, Susan, was fairly interesting.
Nuh-uh.
Nuh-uh.
No, they didn't.
No, you didn't.
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, Donald Trump essentially just said, I don't believe them, and actually went sort of further. His transition team issued a statement saying, these are the same people that thought that there were weapons of mass destruction, Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. I mean, he really sort of lashed out rather strongly at the CIA and then spent the following days doubling down on that. So it's a relatively extraordinary response. It raises some real questions about what his relationship with the intelligence community will look like going forward.
A little awkward to start.
Right. A number of his high-profile surrogates have also started to circulate the theory that this is, quote, a false flag operation.
Right. John Bolton put that out there.
Right.
Possible Deputy Secretary of State.
Right. Carter Page apparently has also been circulating this talking point
he's back.
In Moscow. He's back.
Good.
He's back, guys.
Oh, good. That's nice.
Right, so sort of this, maybe it was actually China, maybe it was once again a guy on a bed. He brought that up. He didn't mention 400 pounds, so he's past fat shaming. But I think it is sort of important to understand the body of evidence that exists that might be lost on some of the broader public unless they've been following the story. I would highly recommend the excellent article in Esquire by one Thomas Ridd, chronicling the various evidence.
Sort of the definitive capstone piece, I think, actually.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, actually, that that Trump and those around him can cast as much doubt as they can on something that has been so thoroughly reported and, nay, chronicled by Thomas Ridd. And I wish that we just had some way of getting Thomas Ridd
awesome.
Here
only
on the
we
podcast.
Could snap our fingers.
Hold on. Wait.
No.
Ladies and gentlemen, we happen to have right here in the Jungle Studio one Thomas Ridd.
Welcome, Thomas.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Hi, welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're glad you're here.
We're very glad, you're here.
He's clearly surprised to appeared out of thin air.
Magically we pulled you out of whatever you were doing and now you materialized here in the Jungle Studio. Thomas, seriously, thanks for being here. You did write, I think, what many people regard as one of the definitive, if probably the definitive article, putting together everything that we know about the hackers, sometimes known as Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear, sometimes known as the Dukes. Start with just maybe your reaction both to, I'd love to know what you think about the CIA's reported assessment that this was done to help Trump, but also, you know, Trump pushing back on this and saying, as he has in the past, there's just simply no evidence that this was the Russians, you know, despite the fact that all intelligence agencies have said that it was.
Well, you know, I mean, obviously, I feel a bit awkward if people say it's the definitive piece for a number of reasons, but the most important one being that so many other people have spoken about this, researched this, found public evidence, not just me. All I did is collect it in one place and you know, tell it in a way that a broader audience can understand. So, but let's, you know, if there's a 400-pound hacker that you're trying to identify, he is sitting right here in front of us, and you can touch it. And the situation is that some people think, well, you know, they still ask, where's the evidence? But we have 400 pounds of evidence sitting right in front of us, so to speak. We just need to look at it and analyze it. So we have a lot of mistakes that they made in haste. So just a quick backup, DNC hack. There were two different DNC hacks were discovered in late 15, and the second breach was discovered in probably March this year, and then it was made public by the DNC and CrowdStrike on the 14th of June. And then the deadline here is really important because, one, several people, intelligence community, FBI, as well as CrowdStrike, watched what was going on inside the networks in real time. So basically, they caught the hacker in the act, to use a Trumpian phrase. That's one thing. And the other thing is, when the APT-28, Fancy Bear, or GRU were discovered, they very quickly reacted in the span of something like 24 hours, very hastily, accelerating their already existing plan to leak. And because they acted so quickly, they made a number of mistakes that were revealing in hindsight. And obviously, it's more revealing if you look at the mistakes that were made under time pressure than other mistakes that were made deliberately later to false flag.
So you're sort of indicating, I think this is an important point. All right, so there's the initial assessment that comes out from CrowdStrike and the DNC saying it's the Russians. Actually, I think a lot of people did have questions about whether or not it was really fair to say it was Russia. Apparently, these were two groups that were not acting in concert. And then actually, the leaked documents are what provide additional evidence.
Yeah. You know, we can't overstate how much the threat intelligence community, both in government as well as in industry, already know about these two actors. I mean, literally in September this year, we had the 20th anniversary of discovering one of these actors inside a U.S. network. And that's 20 years, two decades. And it took them, back in 1996, it took them a while to discover the scale of the operation. But I think the first time was in the summer of 1998 when the U.S. government, especially the FBI, with help from industry already then, attributed this to Russia and later confirmed the evidence in 1999. So this is not a new phenomenon. The U.S. government has been catching Russian hackers literally for two decades now.
So I think what's interesting about this latest pushback from Trump is not only the pushback on the fact of attribution of this attack to Russia, but the subsequent wave of complaints that the CIA's attribution of motive, in other words, that the Russians did this to affect the election, to hurt Hillary Clinton by implication, to support Donald Trump, that's also getting a lot of pushback. And today there was, you know, news that the ODNI, the Director of National Intelligence Office, disagreed with the CIA's ascription of motive to the attack. So what are we to make of this debate?
So look, from sort of my perspective, there is always it's not uncommon for there to be some marginal disputes among the various intelligence agencies. And so if we want to look at where is sort of the core area of agreement, it's that statement that ODNI and DHS put out. Those statements are released through an interagency process. Everybody signs off on them. Any intelligence agency that does not sign off can actually do a formal non-concur, right? They say we don't want to be a part of this. We don't sign off on this. And so those that statement, which was so remarkably detailed and so sort of forward-leaning in terms of attributing directly to the Russian government, it really does stop short of ascribing that specific motive. So I think that it's fair to say the only debate here, the only meaningful debate, is whether or not the existing body of evidence is sufficient to say with any level of confidence that the motive here was to elect Donald Trump, as opposed to undermine the sort of the election generally, potentially harm Hillary Clinton, right? I mean, whenever we think about the shades of nuance and the difference between a motivation of wanting to hurt Hillary Clinton and help Donald Trump, right? These are very, very minor differences. Yeah. So to the extent that there's a difference of opinion between apparently sort of CIA, NSA, the FBI, and now apparently ODNI, we're talking about sort of very minor questions of how much weight they give particular pieces of evidence. I think Trump is now attempting to drive a truck through that by saying, hey, look, they don't even agree. Well, they agree on all of the all of the pertinent facts.
Right. And I think what's interesting about that, I think you're totally right. I mean, is the baseline, this was done to interfere with the elections, as to use the words that were in that statement. There's agreement on that, and that can cover all manner of interference, whether it's done for one party or another, one candidate or another, et cetera. I think that the distinction, I think you're right, that it's getting then to helping one candidate is not that much farther in terms of the distinction. But for the political purposes of the president-elect coming in and believing that the intelligence community he's about to direct views him as potentially a threat. I don't know if we go so far as to say illegitimately elected, obviously not, because there's no evidence that they actually hacked the votes, but, you know, views him with at the very least some trepidation, which they probably did before. It's fairly clear to say that. And there were people even saying that, in fact, Mike Hayden writing openly saying he was an unwitting agent of the Russian government. But I wonder what you guys think about now. How does, like, what does it look like when an intelligence community now kind of welcomes in is the wrong word, but has a president-elect that has a president that clearly believes they were out to, you know, somehow sandbag him, right?
Well, I don't know if it's that so much. I mean, first of all, I don't know that you need sort of direct evidence of explicit intent in order to conclude from the set of facts that the nature of the intervention indicates it was intended for a certain purpose. And I think, Thomas, you lay this out very well in your piece, that the sequence of what they released and how they released it was clearly directed against the Democratic side in the race. And so you can infer intent, I think, pretty reasonably from that. But the second thing is, you know, with regard to your broader question, Shane, which I think is a good one, We have Trump, who has denigrated this specific piece of analysis and cast doubt on the veracity of the intelligence community in general. He's said explicitly that he doesn't need daily intelligence briefings and they just tell him the same things over and over again, and it's not that useful. And we've seen that throughout his campaign and since being elected, what he's interested in is creating his own frame for issues and his own set of facts that he puts forward, regardless of what other facts might be out there and relevant to the issue. And so I think his rejection of the intelligence community and of intelligence information is just part of a broader strategy to make sure he's the guy who controls the narrative, 100% control.
Also, I think I agree. As you say, we can infer intent from some of their behavior. And for instance, as the CIA statement implies, or story implies, they probably, I would assume that somebody knows or has seen that that the Russian operators breached the RNC, exfiltrated files from the RNC, the Republican National Committee, but did not make these files public. And that would confirm what you already said, that there was an intent to help only one side. But I think I would go even further, because I think what we see here is this operation is not over. The fact that we're having this conversation right now, the fact that you have this extraordinary friction right now between the intelligence community and the president-elect, between the Democrats and the Republicans, a highly politicized environment here. This is a direct success of this operation. This is not disconnected from the operation. This is the operation itself. And I would go even further than that. Just listen to what the president-elect tweeted and said from, you know, a Russian or a Chinese perspective. What he's saying, in, you know, translated into even plainer English, is, I'm not seeing you. Go ahead, hack us, hack our allies. Go ahead, hack Germany. We will stop calling you out.
I think this is one of the reasons why this is such a significant story and one that's not going away. So we have sort of the intelligence community in Germany, as well as the intelligence community in the UK, now reporting that they are seeing substantial activity, hacking activity directed against their upcoming elections. Of course, the German election having sort of relatively substantial implications for kind of the future of the European project in general.
The liberal international order. The free world.
For example. You know, and I think it wouldn't be sort of, I don't think it would be ridiculous to predict that maybe the next candidate who gets a little boost might be, I don't know, Marine Le Pen in France. Do we even call it populist? Are we allowed to say?
Yeah, right wing.
Right wing.
Yeah, it's generally called right wing.
Nativist. Yeah. Nativist,
sure, that's
I
a nice
think.
Word for it. Right, so these the way we respond to this is going to be incredibly significant. Just a few hours ago, the New York Times published a very long sort of deep dive, some of which rehashes your article, Thomas, that sort of is the story about what happened from kind of the DNC and the White House's perspective, right? So sort of what the story looks like, how the DNC sort of fumbled the response, how the White House kind of fumbled the response.
Very slow response, actually, it seems like.
Yeah, although one wonders whether the White House reticence was fumbling. I mean, in retrospect, maybe you can say it was a wrong judgment, but it seemed pretty deliberate reticence that they wanted
caution,
to avoid politicization of exactly the kind that Thomas is pointing out. And Thomas, I think that's an important point, that we're not done with this and the effects of it are still being felt and they are likely to do more in order to prolong those effects or exacerbate them. To me, what's significant is that into that breach has stepped a bipartisan group of senators now, including the majority and minority leader of the Senate and relevant committee chairman and ranking members, saying that they are going to work together on a collective investigation of Russian hacking in the campaign, of the DNC hack in particular, of what the purpose of it was, but also of the broader problem of nation-sponsored cyber hacking and what it means for our national security. And it seems to me that it's that kind of of action, it's that kind of initiative that can help to mitigate the effect of what the Russians have done, if indeed their primary goal was to create that partisan divide.
Yeah, can I just come in with a sort of a critical observation, because I think it's really important to point that out. The story that you mentioned, Susan, in the New York Times that just came out has some extraordinary detail in it. Among that is the way the FBI, if you like, authenticated itself to the DNC when they warned. So they warned the DNC, hey, you have a problem. But they didn't want to email them, obviously, because their network was compromised. So they called them. But it's really hard on the phone to identify yourself as a legitimate FBI agent. So apparently, if this account is correct, and we don't know yet, the FBI hasn't said anything yet. I mean, what I'm seeing is highly unprofessional behavior. If this is a high-profile case, the intelligence community in this country should have been aware, and probably was aware, that Russians have a long history of information operations, even using hacked material in 2015 in Saudi Arabia already. So I'm really surprised that they were not on top of this earlier in this entire affair, and it only came in with this major statement in, you know, October, 1 month before the election.
Yeah. Right. So I do agree. I mean, so the FBI was clearly slow on the draw here. One thing that
they were busy investigating the server.
Right. They had other things to do. One thing, I mean, sort of in fairness to the FBI, you know, the ability of the FBI to sort of make a victim notification is and sort of warn people is relatively limited. Right. So if it's not a government system, if it's a private actor, sort of typically the most you can do is kind of do a warning. I agree. Unbelievable that they wouldn't walk half a mile or a mile, you know, to the DNC headquarters.
To do the warning in person?
To actually, you know, show them a badge. But I read that story of sort of, you know, repeated and increasingly frantic phone calls with this kind of junior DNC staffer who's like not taking it seriously. I think there's a pretty egregious breaches kind of on both sides there.
Yeah, clearly.
Okay, let's move on to our next segment. After a long... long, long drama.
It was so entertaining.
Keeping you in suspense.
Almost a full season.
I was on the edge of my seat for weeks.
The final rose for Secretary of State goes to Rex Tillerson. Rex Tillerson, will you be my Secretary of State?
What a show. What a show.
So good. I can't wait for season two. Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson, obviously. RexSec. I'm telling you, it's going to catch on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Keep working on that, Shane.
Keep working on it.
XT, maybe?
Yeah, Rex T. T-Rex.
There S-Rex. You go.
That's good. Now we're getting somewhere.
Rex Thomas, T- I knew there was a reason
did
you
say
we brought
Rex
you
T?
Here.
Well,
T-Rex.
T-Rex.
Rex T.
Rex
yeah.
T, I like it. All right. So, not exactly. I mean, look, I mean, some of his supporters are saying if you wanted to pick a CEO that had, you know, global leadership acumen in spades, you probably would pick someone who runs a company that, as Fareed Zakaria said, is almost like a country. It's so large and has so many operations in the world. we don't traditionally go to necessarily CEOs. Necessarily do we always go to ones that are friends with Vladimir Putin. And certainly in the current environment, that raises some eyebrows. But tomorrow, we magically have a former senior State Department official here in our midst.
Who did not come from the private sector.
From the private sector. Kind of break this down for us a bit. I mean, A, your reaction, but B, sort of how should we initially be thinking of Rex Tillerson in this role of the most prominent cabinet position in the government?
So I think that initial reactions to the Tillerson appointment have centered around two things. One, quite naturally, is his relationship with Putin, which apparently is one of mutual admiration. And certainly Exxon has some major business in Russia at the moment. And certainly it is true that Exxon has assiduously opposed American sanctions on Russia and that Tillerson himself has lobbied the government to lift those sanctions. The other dimension is just that he's coming out of the energy sector and therefore he, you know, is assumed to embrace a set of interests that are quite different from those of the current administration. Of course, that's what happens with elections, and we're seeing that with a number of these personnel appointments. But I think one of the things that's interesting and maybe worth a little bit of debate is the question of having a CEO of a multinational corporation nominated to a job like this. There are a lot of people who are saying this isn't relevant experience, or even that, you know, it's completely unqualified, and that this isn't the kind of person you should have. And my colleague Suzanne Maloney actually has a piece in the Wall Street Journal today pushing back on precisely that point. Suzanne, full disclosure, did work for ExxonMobil for a couple of years, a number of years ago, and she did not work directly for Tillerson. But she makes the point that a multinational corporation, one that does business in a wide variety of environments, and especially one like ExxonMobil, that like every other oil company, goes into environments that are fraught with political risk, that are often fraught with conflict, because a lot of natural resource-rich states are difficult political environments and difficult security environments, that somebody who's a CEO of a company like that actually does have a lot of experience dealing with politics and diplomacy, dealing with the governments who often control the energy sector in their countries. And so it actually can be quite relevant experience and certainly isn't worth dismissing out of hand. Now, you know, all that said, I think it's reasonable to point out that an oil company's interests in engaging in that kind of diplomacy are quite different from the interests of the United States of America. But I think that that allows you to focus in when it comes to confirmation hearings on how this guy understands American interests and what he's willing to say about a set of traditional American foreign policy interests that relate to peaceful conflict resolution, human rights, free markets and transparency and anti-corruption and things like that. And so I wouldn't say that I am reassured by Suzanne's argument that the CEO of ExxonMobil has relevant experience to be Secretary of State, but I do think it's worth considering.
So I think that it's sort of it's unreasonable to think Tillerson is sort of all bad or all good, right? Of course, like anyone else, he's going to bring some strengths and weaknesses. So I think sort of it's a little bit of a straw man of, does he have any pertinent experience whatsoever or not? Well, I don't know that anyone was really making that case. Certainly, he's operated in some difficult environments. That's relevant experience. I would think that we would also be concerned or focused on not just the fact that somebody operated in an environment, but actually what they did there. And so one of the things that I think is most telling isn't just sort of this purported friendship with Vladimir Putin, which for reasons that I want to discuss in a moment are significant, but also looking at sort of his evolution as he operates in, for example, Russia. So Julia Yaffe has reported this a fairly detailed story about sort of Tillerson's, let's say, evolution from somebody who really went from being quite strident about the importance of the rule of law in Russia and that Russia needed to sort of establish itself as a rule of law country to presumably to allow companies to operate. And then as sort of over the 6 years in which from the outside perspective, Russia becomes less and less committed to the rule of law, Tillerson becomes friendlier and friendlier and friendlier, sort of culminating in this order of friendship, sort of official designation from Vladimir Putin.
I would note, too, that that's a pretty common evolution for CEOs of large corporations with operations abroad. They often start out talking to dictators about the necessity of rule of law and transparency, and then evolve to taking advantage of the business opportunities before them.
Right, but
Trump might see as an asset. That's a negotiating strategy, right?
And whenever we're evaluating him in the context of being Donald Trump's Secretary of State, and we already know that Donald Trump has these sort of mercantilist impulses, I'm not reassured by sort of Rex Tillerson. I have no doubt he might be effective in operating in that space. I do think, though, there's significant questions about effective to what ends. I'm not convinced that the ends he's going to set himself to, nor the ends that Donald Trump is going to set himself to, are consonant with either America's interests, nor some of our sort of bedrock principles, commitments to democracy, human rights, etc.
Maybe I can just bring in an unusual angle to this discussion. So if you look at T-Rex from a Russian perspective, in a way he presents a problem for them in his new role, because it's a bit like the great Satan in Iran. the ideology that Putin has erected is based on anti-Americanism to a significant degree, on anti-Western ideology, sentiment. So if you suddenly, if the great Satan is suddenly a good friend of yours, you know, you run into ideological problems of justification, if you like. So in a way, I think they must be quite a bit concerned about how to deal with this in the future because they haven't been there before.
So I think this is a really important point, that the selection of Tillerson sends a very specific message to Russia, and it's one that I think the confirmation hearings should focus on. So sort of going back to our first segment, most reasonable rational people can, you know, agree that the Russians attempted to interfere in our elections for some purpose. Obviously, they are now pivoting to European elections. There is a need for a deterrent response. If we do not counter this behavior, explain to them that this is really not something they want to do, we're likely to see this continue and actually escalate, right? Just like we've seen sort of the cycle of escalation from intrusions and espionage up to doxing and sort of more active measures. Thinking about the selection of Rex Tillerson in that context, right? So sort of Russia has purportedly attempted to help Donald Trump get elected. Donald Trump gets elected, and then the reward is the Secretary of State who has unabashedly pro-Russia sentiments. I agree that this might be sort of an uncomfortable messaging position for Vladimir Putin. That said, considering the state of the Russian economy, And Tillerson's commitments to wanting to lift sanctions on Russia, saying they are, quote, ineffective despite all evidence to the contrary, the level of how big of a win this would be, the level of success that this operation would be to the Russians would be so extraordinary that it's hard to imagine why they wouldn't try this again, even if they only succeeded on this level 1 out of 100 or 1,000 times. Certainly it would be worth it.
And okay, but I feel like you and Thomas are posing very opposite potential pathways from the same event. So, you know, he could be Nixon goes to China. He could be the former Russophile business doer with Putin who has to, you know, who comes out tough against the Russians. Or he could be Russia's best friend. And we don't know the answer to that yet. And one of the ways that the expectations are going to be set for him, the constraints are going to be set for him, and the message is going to be sent to Russia is through his confirmation process and through the context in which he takes office, which will include this Senate investigation and whatever else comes out about Russian hacking between now and, you know, and February, presumably, by the time he gets up for hearings and so on. So I think that I agree with all of your reasons for potential concern, Susan. I just don't think that we can necessarily make a conclusion yet about what this is going to mean. There's one other issue I wanted to raise about Tillerson, though, because we can and should and will talk a lot about his attitudes toward Russia and toward sanctions on Russia. But there's also his attitude towards sanctions more broadly and other sanctioned states like Iran, where ExxonMobil also, you know, once did business, would love to do business, at where sanctions have been a major tool. But more broadly, over the Bush administration and more so the Obama administration, sanctions have become such a big part of the American policy toolbox to leverage against unfriendly states. And if this guy, you know, has a prejudice against sanctions based on his own experience, that is going to be a challenge.
Okay. Let's move on to our final segment. Possibly some good news here to end on this week. It was reported this week that American officials believe that Austin Tice, who was a journalist abducted in Syria 4 years ago, is still alive. John Cornyn, U.S. Senator, came out last week and talked about this. The president's special envoy for hostage affairs has said the government has, quote, high confidence that Tice remains alive. Austin is 35. He has been obviously the subject of a lot of foreign policy attention, a lot of attention from journalists as well. And it's kind of become one of the He's not the only American left abroad. In fact, there is at least two Americans that we know of, one of whom has not been identified, as well as a woman with her family who's being held in Afghanistan. But Austin has kind of become this sort of lingering symbol, sort of in the way maybe Jason Rezaian was a little bit when he was in Iran, as this very kind of visible, potent symbol, because he's a journalist, of the crisis of American hostages held abroad. How do we start to think of what this means at the end of the Obama administration? Do they see this as work undone, that not all of these people have been brought back? And I'm curious to know, from my perspective, I assume that the Trump administration will absolutely, you know, make an effort to get these people back. And you might even imagine seeing Donald Trump possibly talking about it. I mean, he was outraged by the videos of ISIS beheading journalists and referred to this frequently for his calls to get tougher on ISIS. But obviously there are diplomatic channels and strategies in play here that are trying to bring these people back. It's not so much always a military effort. But I'm kind of curious what you guys think of in terms of what happens now for these Americans. Any chance they might even come back in a sort of, you know, final moment before the curtain closes on the Obama administration?
So I would be surprised if we saw sort of a last-minute operation, especially considering sort of the state on the ground in Syria at the moment, although I suppose anything is possible. I'm sure if the Obama administration saw an opening, they would unequivocally take it. Certainly Senator Cornyn deserves a lot of credit for really keeping this story in the news. Austin Tice is from Texas, and so is one of Cornyn's constituents, and he really has been quite dogged in sort of in pursuing this story. The museum has sort of this huge banner of Tice kind of up on the wall as sort of this enduring reminder. I do think it's sort of worth thinking about the fate of people like Tice in the context of sort of a Trump administration. Hostage rescue and hostage negotiation is probably one of the most delicate diplomatic and operational dances that we do. It's an incredibly fraught, delicate situation in which you, you need to apply sufficient pressure, but you also, they have the person, they're sort of at your mercy, and these very careful back channels and very small errors can lead to really significant consequences. It's also an area in which intelligence actually plays a really, really high, is really, really important. So Senator Cornyn on the floor noted that there is high confidence that Austin Tice is still alive.
Which is a very telling term. I mean,
it's
essentially saying it's an intelligence
term.
It's we're almost certain. Yeah,
right.
It's as close as you get.
Exactly. One, great news that they're almost certain he's still alive. But two, using the term high confidence, that's a relatively strong sign that that's an intelligence. The intelligence community has concluded that they believe Tice is alive. So this is an area in which, as we start to think about sort of the importance of intelligence and also sort of the importance in not everything being kind of brute force diplomacy and sort of the screw China, screw you guys, let's just tweet our way out of this. These are really delicate situations. And so whether or not this is an area in which Trump will really take a step back, recognize that this is an area in which expertise is incredibly important. These tend to be the operations in which we are most forward-leaning in putting our military members kind of at immediate risk. So whether or not he really will defer here, because it's hard to imagine sort of a more dramatic crystallization of the importance of the system that Trump really has been inclined to reject thus far.
And the expertise that he has so devalued. Susan, I agree with everything you just said. I would just add that this is also a policy area where the policy risks and the political risks for a president in making the decisions about how to pursue freedom for hostages, whether you do it using a military strike, whether you risk killing the hostage, whether you put special forces in harm's way, whether you do a somewhat unsavory deal with a nasty government or work through a third party, a third government that might not be your best friend to help free these people. These are political risks that a president has to be willing to take on in order to bring American citizens back home. And it's hard to imagine someone with the personality of President-elect Trump taking on those personal political risks to do that. So I, you know, to me, that does not bode well. I think also it's been a really fraught experience for the Obama administration. We've seen them really struggle with it quite publicly at times, come in for tremendous criticism from hostages' families, and as a result, revamp their policy, make it more transparent, share more information with families. And, you know, is that going to continue?
Can I offer just like, I'm going to completely imagine a counter hypothetical. Like, and I'm going to put Trump on the couch a little bit here and also think about sort of what needs to get done and maybe what's not being done with hostage policy. Imagine Donald Trump comes in, brings the families to the White House, has a private meeting with them, says, I think you were treated terribly by the previous administration. No one talked to you about your beautiful children. I will never do that to you. I will make this my mission to get them back. And then realizes that there is a whole apparatus that's been set up, partly through the FBI, partly through the State Department, that is trying to engage in essentially deal-making behind the scenes. And the objective is to get these people home. He knows that the reward is someone flying home on a plane. He might even go there to meet them. And possibly looks at these people in the State Department especially who are working on this and says, I get it. This is about negotiations. This is about strategy. This is about trading, deal-making. And really decides to get in there and try to do that.
That's the best possible
maybe I'm giving too much credit, but like there is like this is brokering to some extent, and to the extent that, you know, he's broken so many sort of mores and areas of foreign policy, why wouldn't he possibly break the quote unquote we don't negotiate with terrorists, quote unquote
right. we don't pay ransoms.
Well, we know we sorta kinda do in a lot of instances.
Right. So I do think I think it's totally possible that sort of his instinct will be sort of a cowboy get in there, you know, no man left behind kind of. So I can see him one ordering aggressive military operations, which are not inconsequential.
And probably won't work.
Right. Are unlikely to work if he has a major failure there. For
which
example.
Jim Mattis would probably tell him, by the way.
Yeah. Right. And so this depends on the extent to which he decides to defer to expertise. So I can see him looking at that apparatus, being really committed to wanting to see people come home and saying, you people, you don't get it done. I'm going to get it done. Now, there could be some positive shifts in hostage policy, right? So as the Europeans do, the United States could start to acknowledge that, we actually do negotiate with terrorists. We do pay ransoms, lifting some of the laws that have put families in very difficult situations, because of course it is actually illegal to pay ransoms, even though the government has sort of turned a blind eye to that activity. So maybe there'll be some positive reforms, but the idea that whether he either totally ignores this and doesn't want to get it sort of entrapped in the political mess that these situations can cause, or if he comes in kind of kick the door down, guns blazing, I fear that there could be negative consequences.
This is going to be a fascinating one to watch.
Well, go ahead. Sorry, just quick observation. I think given the breach of trust between the transition team, president-elect, and the intelligence community, I wonder what the likelihood is that, I mean, there will be a great reluctance to share information with the president that if he leaks that information, mm-hmm. and he's leaked his own, you know, announcements again and again ahead of time, that could have life and death consequences.
Wow.
Yeah,
right.
There's a question of, I mean, the it's an interesting observation, Thomas, because, I mean, this the way that the administration, and I've been in this position too, of knowing the name of an American hostage that we did not report, but the extent to which forces in the administration kind of marshaled to plead with us, do not publish this for the following reasons. You wonder if maybe they would say, maybe don't give him a name, maybe don't tell him where the hostage is.
Look, at some point,
and maybe the president doesn't need, any president doesn't need to know that specific information.
Right, so I can certainly see the intelligence community being more conservative in terms of how much information needs to kind of leave the building. But at the end of the day, the notion that the IC would or should actively prevent the president of the United States from having access to intelligence information, that's a really, really dangerous path to start walking down. It's one I think there will be a lot of resistance to in the IC. I do think sort of the prevailing view is the only thing worse than Donald Trump with classified information is an intelligence community that substitutes its independent judgment for the democratic judgment, you know, influenced or otherwise, of the American people. That really has some rather troubling end results.
Yeah. Bigly.
Bigly.
Okay, let's move on to object lessons. I'll go first. I'll do two objects. Actually, first, let me just flag our guest Thomas Stridd's book, Rise of the Machines, A Cybernetic History, which you should definitely go check out.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also want to flag another book that we got multiple copies of this in the Bureau this week, Warriors and Citizens by one, edited at least, by one Jim Mattis. You may have heard of him. He's going to be Secretary of Defense. And Corey Shockey, who we know and love, friend
love
of the podcast.
Corey. Friend of the podcast, friend of all.
Mad Dog Mattis, it's nice you edited a book, but we're really excited that Corey has edited a book.
Totally.
But this is it's edited by the two of them, subtitled American Views of Our Military. A group of contributors offer these different perspectives on whether or not the different experiences of military and the broader society amounts to a gap, essentially, in the American public. I'm reading here from the Amazon jacket cover. And losing
America. I believe that one of those contributors is our own Benjamin Wittes.
He might be in the book. I might be log rolling for Ben in his absence.
Oh, wow.
He's off gallivanting around the Levant. Taking helicopter rides. I think it'll be very interesting to obviously this book was in the works before Jim Mattis realized that he was going to be the Secretary of Defense, or at least the nominee. But it's not every day that a new book lands by such a prominent cabinet nominee. But people, I think, will probably start turning to this and other things that Mattis has written and talked about, particularly his views, I think, on what the proper role of generals is, what the proper role of the military is, which he has said our job is not to make policy, it is to implement policy. Now he's going to be a policy maker. It'll be interesting to see, I think, whether Donald Trump wants more generals, as he's been calling them his generals. He's appointed a lot of retired generals to top positions, wants them to be in the military even more policy focused. Watch this space. Check out the book, Warriors and Citizens.
Well, I'll go next. And my object this week is a short story, and it's not a newly published short story. It was published in Yiddish in 1946 in a newspaper in Buenos Aires by a guy named Tzvi Kolitz. And it's called Yossi Rockover Talks to God. And the story is set in the Warsaw Ghetto in 1943. And it is described as the last testament of a Jew trapped in the ghetto, Yossi Rockover. And I thought of this story today. Actually, it was mentioned to me by a friend because of what is happening in Aleppo. As we speak, in the last days, the Russians, Syrians, and Iranians have aggressively stepped up their efforts to retake the city, devoting air power, artillery, and ground forces to an operation not allowing civilians to leave except across the line to the regime side, where there are numerous reports that women and children are being shot on sight and men are being forcibly conscripted to fight their brethren in the Syrian army, conscripted into the Syrian army to fight their brethren back on the other side of the line. And they have been doing this as ISIS retook Palmyra, which demonstrates the extent to which the Russians are really in this to support Bashar al-Assad and destroy the opposition, and not to fight terrorism. So I'm just going to read you a very, very brief excerpt of this last testament of Yossi Rockover, I think because it illustrates the horror of such situations and the testimony that I think you can see if you look on social media flowing out of Aleppo these last few days, which is truly, truly horrifying. You know, what can we hope for at this point? We can hope that that it's possible to arrange enough of a ceasefire to allow civilians to leave and not to leave to regime-held areas, but to leave elsewhere and survive. But in this story, he writes, "A strange thing has happened to us. All our ideas and feelings have changed. Death, quick death that comes in an instant, is to us a deliverer, a liberator who breaks our chains. That is how it is. Such is the spiritual condition we have reached. Life is a calamity, death a liberator, man a plague, beast an ideal, day an abomination, night a comfort. Millions of people in the great wide world, in love with the day, the sun, and the light, neither know nor have the slightest intimation of the darkness and calamity the sun brings us." I will get this posted on our podcast page. I urge you all to take a look and to stand as you can stand with Aleppo in these dark, dark days.
Thanks, Tamara.
Well, it's hard to follow that. My own escapism to escape some of these news, including some of the political news in Europe and the United States over the past months, has been to delve into a project on encryption history back into the Renaissance, into the 15th century. And I think what I'd just like to say, because it's just so extraordinary, is what Google, and especially Google Books, have done. It is today possible on your phone, if you want to, on your iPad, to check a source from a publication in the 17th century that you're reading in full, whether the letter that they quote from 1506 sent to some guy in Belgium from some guy in Germany in Latin, whether that's actually correctly quoted, and you can check the full text of the translation, and it takes you a few seconds. It is absolutely extraordinary. So I think a big shout out to Google Books is my object lesson. Like
shout that. Out to Google Books, and no excuses, students, for not having your footnotes properly documented.
Susan, what's your object?
So my object lesson is an extra special object lesson to me. And it is a rather cheesy TLC Untold Stories of the ER episode, which is this sort of like melodrama of real events that occurred, of which yours truly is the star of one. I know. I'll send your autographs later.
Oh,
this is very exciting.
I saw it at like 3:30 in the morning.
I know.
Susan, you're famous at 3:30 in the morning.
Exactly. I'm very famous. So 10 years ago today, when I was 21 years old, I had a pulmonary embolism, which is a massive blood clot that comes into your heart. And I had a massive heart attack. And I am actually the one of the longest cases of CPR in medical history. I am in medical textbooks.
Whoa.
Of someone having the duration of CPR that I did without any brain damage.
How long?
109 minutes. including with fixed dilated pupils. It's very
impressive. I'd just like to suggest that we don't actually know how much brain damage you suffered. You might have been the next Einstein.
That's true. You know what? That is true.
Because we know that you are smoking hot smart. Mm-hmm, so just imagine. Mm-hmm.
You exactly. were sent to deliver us.
Exactly.
And now you're on
or maybe it gave me superpowers, one way or the other. So 109 minutes, that's 13,000 chest compressions.
That's amazing.
My object lesson is not just this somewhat silly episode, which is a weird sort of a memento.
What's the name of the show again?
We'll post it online. Nobody needs to look into this. Nobody needs to look into this. I also really object to the actress that played me. I just on vanity grounds. But in sort of the course of this very, very long CPR, the attending physician was prevailed upon many times to stop, not because the other doctors were lazy, but because the worst outcome is resuscitating someone that, of course, will not regain brain function, and they thought that I had passed that point. And my physician, whose name is Richard Sonner, for some reason decided sort of not to give up on me that night and said, "I am in charge, and I will take the legal risks." They did stuff that was sort of medically contraindicated. I will take on the ethical risks, and you will keep doing this until I tell you to stop. And so for 109 minutes, damn it, he sort of directed this pretty extraordinary thing. obviously, I'm personally pretty grateful to him, and we have a wonderful relationship now. He was at my college graduation and my wedding, and is sort of just generally like this, just this really wonderful man. But I sort of I think about that a lot. I think about it today. I think about it as we sort of see really, really terrible images coming out of Aleppo, and just sort of feeling like the world is crumbling at times. For some of us, we get these moments of just extraordinary bravery and sort of the ability to have faith in people and professional integrity and ethics and sort of doing what matters. And, you know, I got to go home, you know, 2 months later, it was. But, you know, now I look at my husband, I look at our son, I look at sort of all the amazing things. I look at this podcast, which I'm so incredibly grateful to be part of, and just am filled with gratitude and hope, and am really, really inspired to also sort of take on those kinds of risks and bravery in my own life. So here is to Dr. Sonar, who I will send the link to this podcast, as well as just everybody who stood by me that night, and everything that's happened over the past 10 years, man.
Now we know why you're so fearless.
Yeah. Exactly. That's exactly. Because I literally can't die. Wow. So...
Well, happy anniversary! Of your second.
I'm having this scotch as my celebratory drink.
I love it. Well, that's a great note to end on. And on that brings us to the end of the show. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find links to our show archives at spaghettionthewallproductions.com. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. And when you download the podcast from Stitcher or iTunes, your favorite podcatcher, you know what to do. Leave a 5-star rating, leave a great review. If you're just finding us because somebody gratefully posted a 5-star review, welcome. That means it's working. Putting the love out there brings new people into the fold. We really appreciate it. Our audio engineer for the podcast is Quinta Jurassic. Our editor is Jen Howell. Our music was performed this week by Sexy Rexy and the Trump Tastics.
I knew that was coming in there.
You just
so
had
good.
To do it.
Sexy Rexy and the Putin Riot. No, of course, our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Would she be in a band called Sexy Rexy?
Yeah.
Like Sexy if she was going to be in a band, it would be called Sexy Rexy.
Yeah, it'd be like something like that. Totally. Thanks as always to Sophia. On behalf of my good friends Tamara Kaufman-Wittes and Susan Hennessy and our special guest, Thomas Ridd, who is really great to be here with us in the studio, I'm Shane Harris. We will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.